Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
I'm Devi Desai. I'm the executive director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance.
The first thing that brought perhaps the Taxi Workers Alliance to the attention of people around the country that didn't already know about your work was, of course, the strike at JFK Airport over the Trump's immigration ban. So can you tell us a little bit about how that came to be?
Sure. I mean, you know, we're a workforce that's largely Muslim and Sikh and, you know, almost universally immigrant. I mean, over 94% of drivers in New York City are immigrant. And it's really just across the country, we're a largely immigrant workforce. And so, you know, when the executive orders came down, there was a definite sense of urgency and a lot of anger. And we really were just starting to talk about all the different members we knew who would be affected, and the fact that even though the majority of our Muslim members are not from one of the seven countries in the executive order, still the kind of the hysteria around Islamophobia and the fact that, you know, fear leads to hate crimes was a major concern of ours. And so we felt a real need to act. And on Saturday, the day after the executive orders were signed, when we saw, you know, folks coming out to the airport and protesting, it just felt like the most natural thing to do was for us to stand in solidarity and participate in that action the best way that we know how, which was by striking and holding down that lot.
One of the things that I found the most interesting about this is that there's been a lot of talk about the different problems with Uber as a business model, but the thing that really prompted reports say 200,000 people to delete Uber was that they were strike breaking.
Mm-hmm. It was amazing to see the outpouring of support. I think people were really touched, you know, that here was a workforce that's, you know, on the front lines, both, you know, kind of these hateful policies, but also the economic margins of really what we've seen is, you know, growing sector of the economy, which is piecemealing and turning a full-time profession into part-time gigs. And so, I think generally speaking, people out there know that taxi drivers are really hardworking and that, you know, people really struggle day to day to make ends meet. So the idea that they would put their incomes on the line and it would be a workforce that's so vulnerable, particularly in these times to surveillance and deportations and, you know, further policing, that they would be the ones to stand up, it seemed to really touch people. And we were so moved by the reaction. I think it was, you know, it was a beautiful start to solidarity with our movement. Certainly, there are many reasons to be critical of Uber, and, you know, Uber is a pretty horrible company. And it's true, we've been fighting for a long time to bring attention to Uber's economic practices and the race to the bottom that it's created. That, you know, however people were meant to come and take a, you know, closer look at us, we're ready to accept, and hopefully from this point forward, you know, folks continue with the struggle.
The Taxi Workers Alliance has been organizing with Uber drivers, correct?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit more about the complaints that the drivers have and their connection to organizing with more the traditional taxi workers?
Sure. So in New York City, it's the one Uber market in the whole country where, you know, Uber is a licensed black car base. And so the drivers are all licensed. I mean, Uber in New York City itself does remain under-regulated. But the drivers themselves are licensed and regulated, and you know, many of the Uber drivers used to drive Yellow, and you know, Yellow Taxi were our members, and you know, when they switched to Uber, had retained their membership. So, I mean, this is a company where it's really difficult for people to make ends meet. I mean, we see members who are working like 60 hours a week, retaining like 4.8 ratings, star ratings, and yet they're earning below minimum wage.
Yeah. And you mentioned also, in both the statement and just now, the violence that drivers face, and particularly how that escalates in times when racism and Islamophobia are on the rise. So can you talk a little bit about some of the drivers' experience with some of that?
Absolutely. You know, a few years ago, people will recall there was a lot of controversy in New York City that down the street from, you know, Ground Zero, that an Islamic center had opened, and you know, many of the well-known Islamophobes had taken up the issue as like their main cause, and created a lot of hysteria around it. And you know, folks like Sarah Palin at the time, you know, was more relevant than today, were, you know, heavily weighing in, and the rhetoric was quite hateful and strong. Well, in the midst of all of that, it was one of our members, Ahmed Sharif, who, you know, this was during Ramadan. He picked up a fare, a pretty young guy, started talking to him, and at one point, the passenger asked Ahmed, "Are you Muslim?" And when Ahmed answered yes, he took out a knife and he slashed him across the neck. And, you know, I mean, it's all, you know, we've seen through the years. I mean, right after 9/11, I remember so many neighborhoods, like, you know, primarily immigrant neighborhoods where taxis would be parked and overnight the tires would be slashed. I mean, the yellow cab went from being a kind of a cultural icon, a symbol of New York City, to a symbol of Muslim workers. And, you know, we would see like profanities carved into the taxi with the knife. And so already, like, drivers are 20 times more likely to be killed on the job than other workers. And, but, you know, given that we are a workforce that's very visible, we're one of the most, you know, visible immigrant and Muslim workforces, you know, our members tend to be on the front lines of that hate and violence.
And I understand that anti-racist organizing and discussions have been part of the organizing that the Taxi Workers Alliance has been doing since the beginning, right?
Absolutely. You know, you can't compartmentalize, you know, people's reality and their humanity. And, you know, I remember, you know, Sarah, after like 9/11, like I remember our members being subject to you know, a lot of verbal abuse and physical assault. And at the same time, they lost so much work because all these streets were closed down and they still had to pay for their lease out of pocket. And like, we did a survey and we found that like 1 out of 4 drivers had received an eviction notice from their home. And people were in debt by as much as like $25,000 because they were paying for everything out of pocket and just borrowing money and taking out, you know, credit cards. And at the same time, they were contending with the fact that this country was, you know, was beginning to discuss, you know, military action, within the Middle East, where many of our, in the same countries where many of the members were from. And so you can't keep somebody whole and ignore, you know, a large part of their life, particularly one when it comes to, you know, something as deep-rooted as racism and workplace violence, which given that we represent a workforce that's in the public, you know, the two often intersect in drivers' daily lives.
And so one of the things that also happened in the wake of the taxi workers' strike was the Yemeni business owners closing their businesses, the affectionately termed bodega strike. And so I wonder if you could talk about the connection between those two things and the rise of interest in this kind in strike as a way to resist the Trump administration.
Yeah, it was so wonderful to see. It filled us with such pride and admiration. I think that was, and in particularly to have Yemeni business owners, and given that Yemen is one of the seven named countries, and it was a really, I think, a beautiful show of courage. We've seen it similarly, like in 1998 when we went out on strike against Giuliani. After we had gone out on strike, there was a strike by street vendors and then the students at the city university. And so, we boost each other. You know, we learn from each other and we gain courage from each other. And that really is the essence of solidarity. And I think that particularly, I think strikes, within the labor movement, right? Like we all know that, you work on a campaign and there'll be many months, if not years, of build-up before you go to a strike vote. And it's seen as like the final action and it's a moment of urgency. Well, that's what millions of people are waking up to every single day under this presidency. Yeah. There's a moment of urgency. Like, this is not normal. It's not normal for us to live in the United States of America where we say to the world that refugees from war-torn countries are not welcome onto this land, a land built in so many ways by immigrants. And so, I think we're going to see more and more of such actions. Clearly the White House at the moment seems to be regrouping and, figuring out next strategies, because I think their strategy of, like, blitzkrieging and, bombarding us with one executive order after another, backfired, and it galvanized people rather than exhausting or intimidating us.
Yeah. And so for people who aren't familiar, again, with the Taxi Workers Alliance, take us back to the history of your organization and how it became one of the first non-traditional workers organizations that was accepted into the AFL-CIO.
Mm-hmm. Well, we started organizing in 1996, and then we formally organized the Taxi Workers Alliance in 1998. And we have over 19,000 members today in New York City. And a few years ago, we were given a charter by the Executive Council of the AFL-CIO to form a National Taxi Workers Alliance. And so we have affiliates in six different cities across the country. And we're a grassroots, membership-led, membership-driven organization. In most of our cities, we represent drivers that are independent contractors, like in New York City with the yellow cab drivers. And so, we've worked outside of the National Labor Relations Act. We have no dues checkoff, nobody has to recognize us at the table. Everything we've done, all the progress we've ever made, it's come from our workers, our members going out onto the streets and building a militant, activist-oriented movement.
And, of course, we're already seeing that Republicans in Congress are introducing a national right to work law that Trump has said he's in favor of. Mm-hmm. So as labor moves forward, what are some lessons from the taxi workers organizing and actions that the rest of labor can take?
Well, I tell you, for 20 years, we've been working under conditions that really are right to work. Right to work will go after collective bargaining and unionization. But, for us, the drivers are not even considered employees. And so they don't even have minimum wage and overtime and Social Security contributions, none of the basic protections. And, of course, it's the historic fight that we're up against right now with companies like Uber and Lyft and, the so-called, gig economy players that are really looking to, they're using Wall Street investor money to cement that employment model within our industry, but to do it in a way where at least the one thing we've had over the past 30 years under independent contractorship, which is full-time work and full-time pay, that itself is what's being attacked right now, you know, besides employee status and misclassification by these companies. And I think that the lessons, you know, that are to be offered are, one, you don't do what, for example, the machinists have done with Uber, which is they formed something called the Independent Drivers Guild, which is a company union. You know, they've entered into a private agreement. No one's seen the contract. We know from media, media announcements that it's a 5-year deal. They get money from Uber, and in return, they have agreed to not challenge Uber's misclassification and fight for employee status, even though anybody who knows this industry knows that Uber is more of an employer than anything we've seen in 30 years because of the levels of control that it exerts over the drivers. I think it's really important to, that you have to remain vigilant. You have to allow your organizing to do the work for you. And that you have to fight for, you have to build democratic unionism in order to survive, a right to work era. And we need to fight for, an end to employer intimidation and intrusion when it comes to elections so workers can choose freely, even within a right to work context.
New York is obviously the blue city in a blue state. And so talk about the importance of resistance in cities like New York when you have this kind of right-wing administration in the White House.
Oh, I think local resistance at the city level and at the state level everywhere is going to be so critical. New York is interesting because in New York and California are two states where you can have more statewide initiatives. You can expect to have more statewide initiatives, certainly around, I think, immigration and, fighting against some of the very much like hate-spewed policies that have come out already, and I'm sure, more that are going to follow from the administration. But at the same time, there are still issues in places like New York or California where, I tell you, for example, like when the Delete Uber movement started, and it was in defense of our strike, right? And all these folks who said that, it was important to hold the Uber CEO accountable to his relationship with Trump. Certainly we celebrated when, Travis Kalanick was forced to give up his seat at the Trump table. But at the same time, the real Trumpian connection between Uber and this administration, it's their economic policies. And yet in places like California and New York, we see a lot of support for the so-called gig economy. And a lot of kind of like the, buying into the notion that these companies, which are destroying full-time jobs, misclassifying, lobbying actively to undo like generations-old labor law and labor protections, but somehow because they have, liberal to progressive, democratic operatives working for them as lobbyists, that somehow that makes them okay. Like they're not really Wall Street, even though they're completely funded by Wall Street. I think that's really disturbing and really problematic. And so I think that, the challenge remains that while, that states like New York and California, we have to challenge not only the backward social policies that will come out of this administration, but we also have to hold up, real ideals of economic justice and protect good jobs and protect workers, and not just, not just kind of, you know, undo labor protections that these companies are fighting for.
Yeah. Excellent. And finally, how can people keep up with you and the Taxi Workers Alliance?
Oh, gosh. We really welcome people to keep up with us. Well, you can find us online at www.nytwa.org. We're also pretty active on Facebook and Twitter. And it's definitely the instant way of getting in touch with us. And we welcome people to email us. You know, Sarah, one of the most beautiful things that kind of happened out of the defense of our strike, I can't tell you, every single day we're still getting postcards in the mail from just across the country. And it's so lovely. Like, you see, like, each family member has signed their own name, because, like, you see the different handwriting and different postcards coming in and emails, and it's been amazing to see, and it's such a wonderful feeling, particularly for us, because we are a workforce that's isolated because of the nature of the job itself. And when you consider 94% immigrant, mostly people of color, you know, non-employees on the edges of the economy, we've been politically, you know, isolated for so long. So it's been, it's amazing feeling for us when, you know, kind of the larger community opens their eyes and their hearts to our struggle.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Faillebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.